green Christmas. I'm Mr. Sun. I'm Mr. Heat Blister. I'm Mr. 101. They call me Heat Miser. Whatever I touch starts to melt in my clutch. I'm too much.
That tickles.
Good evening, brothers and sisters, and welcome to another edition of Homebrew Talk, your monthly internet radio program, now in its fourth year, that spreads the homebrew gospel and... See, I change it up and man, I just blow it. One other change coming up. See if you can catch it. We spread the homebrew gospel one carboy at a time here at Homebrew Talk, and it's brought to you by the good people at Grow Radio, Gainesville's own independently run, volunteer-driven, non-corporate, non-profit, completely fantastic radio station. Lots of great programs at growradio.org. Check them all out. My name is John. I am going to be your homebrew jockey tonight. And with me, as always, is my homebrew jockey partner, Ron. Ron and I are both members of the Hogtown Brewers, which, by the way, the Hogtown Brewers also bring you this show. I'm screwing up left and right here. We're doing a little ad-libbing, and that's a good thing, Ron. Ron and I are both members of the Hogtown Brewers. We are longtime homebrewers, both BJC certified homebrew judges, and I am the head brewer, believe it or not, at First Magnitude, Gainesville's newest craft brewery. Hello, Ron.
Hello, John.
Ron, you know, it's almost like a little bit of vintage Christmas here in the heat of August. What's going on with the show tonight?
Well, before we get into that... I believe we are BJCP certified judges.
Did I mess that up too? Yeah. Wow.
You had a great intro,
oh,
BJC.
Man.
And but I like the other part, though, of the upgrade to the intro. You forgot to give the full good full Monty spiel of co-owner and head brewer at First Magnitude.
That is true.
That's a swell upgrade.
Yeah, man, I'll say.
You know, we started out doing... homebrewing 5-gallon pots, 10
yep,
gallons.
True.
And now these days you're doing 2-barrel pilots and even 15-barrel big batches. It's like, you know, every pot we touch brews, you know, beer in our clutch.
I might have to use that one. I like it. Yeah. Upgrading.
I suppose that makes you a homebrew miser.
Ah, all right. Okay. Yes. There you go. Yeah. There you go. Hey, I still have my 8-gallon pot. I'll never get rid of it. I promise you that.
Well, John, chill out. Or don't. You know, if you don't, we've got an interesting technique, so you don't have to chill out, and you can speed up your brew day. And we'll follow that up for you snow misers who do like to chill.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to give out not only info you need, but info you want regarding chill plates. So let's brew.
Oh, some like it hot, but I like it really hot.
Yeah, I know it's not Christmas, and no, I don't care. That little gem, you know, from 1974, the Bass and Rankin, you know, year without a Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Today, it speaks to us. Because today, we're talking about no chill and how to chill with a plate chiller.
Sure.
And surely, you can figure out that how would... Heat Miser Brew, well, he would use a no-chill method.
Yeah, that would be his preferred method, I would think.
Right. Now, first off, you go, well, no-chill, what's that about? You know, hold on there. You know, we've got reasons why we chill.
It goes against everything I've learned. What are you talking about, this no-chill method you speak of?
Yeah, exactly. There's good reasons. For example, you chill, you know, to get your wort out of that temperature zone so that you can avoid allowing bugs from snacking on your wort.
Right.
Don't want that souring up.
No.
Prevents DMS, or more specifically stops the formation of DMS precursors, which will later on create DMS in your beer. And that gives you that cooked corn flavor that is oh so delectable.
Mm-hmm.
And other reasons include inducing a cold break. That's really to clear your beer. And really to induce a cold break, you actually need a fast chill typically.
Right.
And of course, reduce your temperature so you can pitch your yeast.
Get those yeast to working as quickly as possible.
But what if, John, what if I told you you can do no chill and you wouldn't suffer from it? That you can have the advantages of not chilling and... not going to hurt you. Not going to harm you. Would you? You'd consider it, right? You'd ponder it.
I would ponder it. I would ponder it. Okay. I have my doubts, but I have a feeling that you're going to sway my opinion here.
Well, if you think about it, there are a number of advantages if you're able to go through a homebrew brew day and not have to chill your wort. For example, right off the top of your head, you'd think reduce water usage.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, how many gallons do you think you probably waste? Well, not waste, but use up when you chill your wort from 200 degrees down to, you know, even 80 degrees or 70 degrees.
Now, yeah.
It's
considerable.
It's considerable. It's probably around the 50-gallon range because with an immersion chiller, even with a counterflow chiller, you're flowing water for about 20, 30 minutes.
Yep.
And, you know, if you do enough algebra and math and figure out the diameter of your garden hose and all that, you're probably spending about 50 gallons.
Beer making is a water-intensive process.
It is.
But, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about collecting that water in the next segment, so stay tuned.
Yes. And I should mention that those in a know of no chill would happily tell you that the reducing of water usage is the main reason why the modern no-chill method has come about, because this method has risen in popularity with homebrewers in Australia because they have some pretty good strict water restrictions. So they had to get clever, and they came up with a no-chill method. But then again, one would have to remind you that no-chill has been around. It's chilling your wort that's relatively new. And by relatively new, I mean the last couple hundred years. But before that, they didn't really have technology to chill their wort. They've passed over 100 couple hundred years of brewing, and man has been brewing, yay, thousands of years, perhaps.
Now you're saying the Sumerians never had...
They did not have an immersion chiller.
Immersion or counterflow chillers.
There are no fossils,
really,
or remains.
No anthropologic evidence. Okay, all right. Well, so, that sounds like a thesis topic out there sometime. I don't know. Wow.
I guess that what that means is what's old is new again.
Oh.
I should say. Now, of course, another advantage if you didn't have to chill your wort is you'd obviously save time on brew day, probably 20 to 30 minutes.
Sure.
Give or take. That's not shabby. And
that's just for the process, not having to clean up or anything like that.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So maybe even more than that because you don't have to clean that equipment. But here's a real big one is if you're traveling to brew, and you may do this, maybe your club is having a big brew day at someone else's property, which isn't yours. Or maybe you're having some fun going to a beer fest to do a brew demo for them.
There you go.
And you have to bring all your equipment. Well, not having to bring your chiller and your hoses, that saves on bringing equipment. And of course, when you're brewing on the road, it once again, saving time is always very nice. And of course, if done right, you can store your wort for an extended period. Now, of course, there's many methods to do that no matter what you do, but this one also provides it. Now, I do have to mention that the concept of a no-chill brew, it's not something that I just stumbled upon myself just by reading or anything. It was shown and introduced to me by as a technique by a friend of the show and someone known as Dad Dirty Seminole, Mr. Tom Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Tom, if you are listening to this podcast, for God's sakes, put your pants back on. Let's move on, shall we?
Please.
All right. So now you're interested. Okay, maybe I'll think about it, but how does this really work? What are the details? Well, the process of no-chill basically is you go ahead and brew as you normally would all the way up into the end of the boil. probably a little asterisk on that because we're going to talk about hops in a few minutes too. But you're going to brew as normal up to the end of the boil. Then you're going to fill a clean container, affectionately known as the cube, which no doubt from the shape of the container that is typically used. But you will fill a clean container that can hold and store hot liquid. And we will talk about the details of such a container in a minute. Now, because the hot wort goes into the container just needs to be clean. The wort, because it's 200 degrees, mm-hmm. will do the sanitizing.
Cool.
Fair enough. Although, feel free to throw some star sand in that container anyways.
I was going
to
say, another savings on cleaning materials there. That's cool. All right.
Yes, possibly a half teaspoon of star sand.
Something
savings.
Like but, that. You know, it's worth it. Every little bit helps. Yes. Come on.
All right, so the wort is in the container. Now you're going to squeeze the container so the wort goes up into the neck because you want to squeeze out as much air as possible, especially if you're going to do any kind of long storage. Mm-hmm. And then you go ahead and cap it. Then lay that container on its side so that the liquid spreads out and sanitizes the top, all sides, the neck, handle, everything, so it touches everything, basically. Mm-hmm. Do that for about 10 minutes. Then you can go ahead and place that container in your chest freezer or throw it in your car because you got a couple hours to drive back home or whatever, and let it chill at its leisure. Then when it's chilled, possibly the next day, right? That's why you're doing no chill.
Mm-hmm.
You can rack to a carboy, or optionally, go ahead and pitch yeast right into your no chill container, and you would want to go ahead and rig an air lock or a blow off tube with that.
Mm-hmm. So you can ferment in the cube.
Sure.
Crazy.
Why not? Now, about that container, as mentioned, affectionately known as the cube,
mm-hmm.
some requirements this container has to have. Obviously has to hold hot liquid, be food grade quality,
mm-hmm.
and has to be tough enough to deal with the vacuum that's going to occur, because that hot liquid from 200 degrees to room temperature, you're going to create a vacuum,
mm-hmm.
and it's got to be able to hold its shape.
So is there some sort of a pressure relief on the cube, or it just
no.
Okay.
It's just that tough.
Wow. All right.
Now, don't bother to use a glass carboy or a better bottle, plastic, fermenter for this. That would be folly.
Yes. I've seen that happen.
Yes.
Not with the glass one, fortunately, but I have seen a vacuum pulled on a better bottle and was not pretty.
Yeah. Won't make it too far either after it's melted right in your driveway or whatever driveway you're in. And the type of material that basically will take care of all these requirements is material known as high-density polyethylene, or HDPE. Now, a popular container that most no-chill brewers get is a container product called the Winpack by U.S. Plastic. And you go to usplastic.com to go look it up. It's model number 75032. It is a 6-gallon container, about $18 these days, plus shipping. And by the way, if you do want to rig an airlock on it, a number 11.5 drilled stopper should do the trick.
Sweet.
Yeah. Now, you're probably thinking, okay, no chill, gave me some advantages, but hey, you didn't really sway me on that the disadvantages will outweigh it. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that.
All right.
First one that's probably on the top of your head is DMS. We've been told throughout our homebrewing career that get a good boil.
Yep.
And then when you're done boiling, don't put a lid on that pot, because even as you're chilling, you're going to go through temperature zones mm-hmm. where S or DMS precursors are still being created. They're going to evaporate, but then hit the lid and then fall back into your wort. Thus, you may get some cream corn flavor.
Got to drive off those volatiles.
So is DMS a problem with no chill? Turns out, no. First off, there's hundreds and hundreds of brewers that have done this and have reported no problem. But why is that true? Likely true because they do a proper boil. That you got to do a good rolling boil. And how do we like that word to look when it's a good rolling boil?
Like an angry sea.
Like an angry sea with a deadly storm, I admit. So, and you especially need to do this course if your batch has got Pilsner malt in it. You need to do a 90-minute good boil.
Yep.
And the fact that these no-chill brewers have no problem with DMS with a good boil kind of puts that story or warning of you got to put your lid on your pot or else you'll get DMS in your wort. That almost sounds like a good candidate for part two of our one-day future Myth and Lies show.
Okay.
Well, can't deny results. Now, what about your hops? After all, you're not chilling, and your wort is going to stay at 200, 190, whatever, for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you have to adjust your hop schedule? Well, yes, you do.
Okay,
can't get around that. Now, if your recipe is less hop forward, the consensus seems to be go ahead and lag those additions by 20 minutes. For example, if you've got a 30-minute addition, you put it in at 10 minutes. If you put it in at 20 or 15, well, basically, those would probably just go right into the container. Some people experiment by having some of their late additions not in the container, but in first wort hopping.
Mm.
Your mileage will vary, and certainly you'll have to experiment with that with your recipes because you do need to adjust that hop schedule. Now,
so most people are just adjusting the timing of the hop charge rather than reducing the amount of hops.
Correct.
Cool.
Changing the time.
All right.
And a last one, which we all hear about, of why you need to do a fast chill and get cold break out of your wort is because you may get some undue haze. All I can say to that is brewers who address that topic simply claim their beer eventually clears up just fine anyways.
Mm-hmm. And I would suspect you use Whirlflock or Irish Moss or
sure
whatever as one normally would.
Right.
Cool.
And possibly if you're kegging, you know, after the fact, finings such as gelatin can help you out, no doubt.
Sure.
Too. All right. So basically, if you need to shed some equipment and speed up the brew day, consider it an option.
Cool.
Now, up next. That's right. Cool. Up next, we cool things down with plate chillers. You're listening to Homebrew Talk on Grow Radio.
Shown in your eyes, heat of the moment. sit beside the phone? What were the things you wanted for yourself? Teenage ambition sure remembers well. Cause it was the heat of the moment, telling me what your heart meant. Heat of the moment shown in your eyes. Heat of the moment, heat of the moment, heat of the moment shown in your eyes.
All right, welcome back to Homebrew Talk. And that brew tune break was too much.
Smoking hot tune break there. First off, we had a really quirky arrangement of Heat of the Moment. That was Matt the Electrician. And then had the summertime classic, Crazy, Going Crazy from the Heat, David Lee Roth. This little mini supergroup there, Steve Vai on guitar,
right,
Billy
right.
Sheenan playing bass.
Yeah, that was that... year of 1986, that song,
that's,
give or take.
That sounds about right, yeah. About mullet time, cruising the Camaro for me, I think, around that time. Yeah, good stuff.
Yep. And now...
Here he comes now, the big hand.
I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow. I'm Mr. Icicle. 10 below.
Ron, I like that so much that I want you to hold on to that soundbite and maybe use that as my intro for every show.
We can recycle.
Bum, 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 bum. Good stuff. All right. So we're going to go from one extreme to another now. And from talking about the no-chill method, we'll talk about play chillers. So first off, if you're not familiar, talk a little bit about how plate chillers work. And plate chiller, of course, is a type of counterflow chiller in which your hot work flows through a series of copper or stainless steel plates going in one direction, while water flows on the other side of the plates going in the opposite direction. So it's a counterflow type of a chiller. Plate chillers are what pro brewers use because they are by far the most efficient means of chilling wort, and this is because of the amount of surface area that comes in contact with the wort while it's passing through the plates. So, as with everything in brewing, there are advantages and disadvantages, and I figured I would run those advantages and disadvantages down to you. First of all, advantages, well, obviously it really is the best method to chill your wort if you're just looking from purely from an efficiency standpoint. If you use cold liquor, you can easily fill your fermentation vessel with wort at pitching temperature. If you're not able to use cold liquor, you need to keep in mind that you'll only be able to chill your wort to the temperature of the tap water. Here in Florida, that's often in excess of 80 degrees in the summertime. We were knocking out on one of the early batches of the FM pilot and just couldn't figure out why, you know, we were like at 82 degrees. I'm like, wow, what's something's not working here. And then we go take the thermopen over and run it under the tap water. And sure enough, tap water was 82 degrees. So you can only go as cool as the tap water will take you. So how do you go about using cold liquor on a homebrew scale? Well, here in Gainesville, some of us at one time had access to a major university, no names needed to mention here, with plenty of ice machines. So we were able to have a good supply of ice on hand pretty much at all times. And we could fill a cooler with ice and a little water, and it made for a great cold liquor tank. If you do go with this method, I would advise in kind of doing a two-stage knockout and hit your wort with tap water first. That'll bring the temp down, and then start infusing your cold liquor, and that you can, you know, knock it down the rest of the way.
Yeah, I would say that probably knock it down to maybe 110 degrees is probably when you can start using that ice bath or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then again, easily it's really not a problem to get it down to 64, 65, whatever you choose to ferment at. Works really well. So another advantage of using a plate chiller or really any sort of heat exchanger, and Ron, you talked about this a little bit at your on your first segment. Brewing obviously is water intensive. Every point of it, you know, you're using a lot of water to make your beer. But if you can, try to collect that water that's going through your heat exchanger. So your cold liquor is going in at a certain temperature. It's coming out obviously very hot. After it cools your wort. So don't let that run down your driveway. Reroute it back to a holding vessel and add some PBW. And then you've got some good hot caustic water to on hand to clean your kettle and your other items when you're finished knocking out. So,
well, can you do that with 50 gallons worth?
Well, no. I mean, you know, I suppose you could if you have some extremely big vessels laying around. But I guess what I'm saying is, don't you know, even if you have a 10-gallon cooler that you use or something like that, it's just great to collect that water. It's good. It's good hot water. PBW works great. You know, when it's heated, I would say about 120 degree range. It really boost the cleaning ability and can help get grunge off a lot easier. So don't just let that water run into your yard. Even if you're only going to collect 10 gallons of it, well, that's 10 gallons of cleaning water that can really be helpful. I know that when I would knock out at home, I would always take the false bottom out of my mash tun, give that a good rinse in the hot water. So there are things that you can do and be mindful of that. I always, for many years, I used an immersion chiller, and that would take me, you know, 20 or more minutes to knock out to the level I wanted. So I had plenty of water, and that was as soon as I got all those connections, made sure everything was flowing properly during the knockout, then I would immediately break into a cleanup phase and try to take use of that good hot water coming out.
As a plan B, there's some clever home brewers who, when the water gets cold enough, they hook up that hose that's draining all the water into their sprinkler system or sprinkler. So, well, at least it's watering their lawn or something.
Sure.
Better than the driveway down
well,
the driveway.
Well, yeah.
As a plan B.
Right.
C.
Well, yeah, my plan B was the peach tree in my yard. that often got some water during the knockout phase. So that's, yeah. If nothing else, irrigation is a good thing.
And make a garden.
So disadvantages to a plate chiller, well, probably the biggest disadvantage is cost. They are rather expensive and can be cost prohibitive to a lot of folks. The Blickman Therminator will cost you $199. Claims on the Northern Brewer website that it'll work well even if you're not using pumps. It says it'll work well with just a gravity system if that's what you're doing. But, you know, if you want something a little less sexy, but in my opinion, just as effective, check out the plate chillers at Duda Diesel. That's DUDADiesel.com. Their lowest cost 20 plate chiller promises to chill a 10-gallon batch in under 7 minutes for a mere $104.
Bargain.
Bargain. It's a bargain price. So if you're thinking about, is it worth it to make this purchase, one thing to consider is time. You know, you're going to spend more time than in the no-chill method, of course, but plate chillers can take a considerable amount of time off your brew day, and your wort is ready to receive the yeast immediately after chilling. So that'll help. You've heard many times on this show that Ron and I both have, in many occasions, waited until the next day to pitch yeast, and as long as you're really careful with your sanitation, that's really not a problem. But certainly, in my opinion, and I think most others would agree, there's no doubt that the quicker you pitch your yeast, the less chance that you have for infection in your beer. So that's a good thing. And also, it limits your brew day to a single day rather than needing to go back and deal with pitching yeast on day two. Because for me, that was always turned out to be, you know, at least a half hour or more if I'm rehydrating yeast, that sort of thing. So getting it all done in one day is that the cost is certainly worth your extra time there. One thing that is very important to think about with plate chillers is the maintenance. They're great at chilling wort, obviously, but they're also great at harboring funk. So you got to be careful. As with all things in brewing, proper cleaning and sanitation is the key. After each use, you need to flush with hot PBW or whatever your favorite caustic cleaner is, and then clean water. And not only do you need to flush the plate chiller, you need to back flush it. So basically with that, you're going to reverse the direction of the flow through the plate chiller. So you just simply change your input to your output and vice versa, and just get that water and cleaner flowing in the opposite direction. I've seen it many times on our plate chiller for the pilot system that we get it real clean running one direction and then back flushing, and sure enough, it pukes out some hop debris or other, you know, solids, proteins from the boil. So back flushing is really, really important.
Hot plate boogers.
Hot plate boogers. Hot plate bogeys. You don't want any of those. Then there also is the nuclear method, or I guess maybe the convection method. You can, I haven't done this myself, but you can put the whole thing into the oven and heat it up. And that is also a good way to kill any of those nasties that are in there. Now, if you do that, you need to be careful. If you have any plastic parts, you want to remove them. If you have a thermometer, inline thermometer on there, obviously you want to take that off. if you have brass fittings on a stainless steel, I guess it would probably be okay, but I would probably remove all the fittings and just have the plate chiller in there before you bake it up.
what temperature?
You know, I don't know. I don't think it has to be terribly hot. Maybe 250. I would do it for an hour or two, just to be sure. Obviously, it's going to be extremely hot for quite some time, so handling is quite important. But the oven method will certainly take out anything that happens to be living in there. So if you do, if I have sold you this massive sales pitch that I've made, you know, what else do you need?
Do we get a kickback? I didn't get anything for
that
cube.
Come on, due to diesel, hook me up. Most plate chillers do come with garden hose attachments for the water side. Obviously, the water side of it is easy to clean. I mean, there's only water going through that, so there's really no cleaning necessary. But they have garden hose attachments for the water side, and then either half-inch hose barbs or half-inch male MPT on the wort side. So we've outfitted ours with quick disconnects for the water side, which makes getting the hose on and off very easy, and then tri-clover fittings on the wort side. And the tri-clover fittings are the subject of a whole other show, but they make the brew day immensely easier, especially when you get the tri-clover to garden hose fitting. Back flushing becomes a joy at that point.
Ah, nice.
So yeah, that's sort of the lowdown on plate chillers, and you know, going from one extreme, from no chill to the deluxe chill method.
Well, this show is the yin and yang, the 180.
So now that we have achieved balance, I think it's time to sail into another brew tune break. You're listening to Homebrew Talk on Grow Radio.
He's Mr. Sorry.
forever causing you pain. You showed your appreciation by walking out anyway. And that's a cold shot, baby. Yeah, that's a thing. And that's a cold shot, baby.
All right, welcome back to Homebrew Talk, and that tune break might have hurt my head.
A little head banging there at the end, for sure. You know, kind of makes you give that slurpy hangover thing going on. But we started that with the great Stevie Ray Vaughan doing "Cold Shot," one of my favorite SRV songs off my favorite SRV album, "Couldn't Stand the Weather." And then we had a very cool cover of the Queen classic "Stone Cold Crazy." Done by Metallica.
Yeah, you don't say.
Ah, what a gorgeous day. Isn't it a gorgeous day, Mr. Sun?
It's always a nice day with two scoops of raisins, Peter.
Now, I know you can't see the visual, but those are big raisins. Yeah, you know, on the commercial when the sun is holding up those raisins. You know, the sun's huge. How big those you think those raisins are?
Some big raisins.
So this is our typical third segment of the show where we like to, when we can, give some small bonus tips on something we've tried or done that turned out to be not too shabby. And
sure.
I think I'm going to do that one today.
Right on.
So here's the deal. And I bet you it has something to do with raisins.
Mm-hmm. So foreshadowing.
I made this Belgian Doppel and came out pretty good. And I'm sure a lot of homebrewers come out with a very, very respectable Belgian Doppel. But I made Belgian Doubles for, you know, several batches, and I wanted to just do something a little different. And this isn't completely extremely original whatsoever, because this technique is done in many different ways. But it's really the first time I've done it for myself. It turned out pretty good. So I'm going to tell you that how I did it, and it worked out. And maybe if it inspires you to give that a shot for your own, then bonus to you. So what I did was I decided with my Belgian Doppel, well, first off, what's one of the flavor profiles in a Belgian Doppel? Well, it's malty, got some dark fruit, and one of those dark fruit flavors is raisin. And you get the raisin flavor pretty much from having special B malt.
Special B.
Ah, special. Mm-hmm. And B in your Billgrist. But
or your
I wanted to enhance.
Bill.
What was that?
Or your grist pill. I had to correct you. You corrected me earlier.
My
so.
English teacher here today. So I wanted to try something to I've done it before where I've taken, say, my barley wine, and I would put some oak cubes that were soaked in whiskey into it. Turned out great. So using that concept, well, okay, I'm not going to use wood cubes, but I'm going to use raisins. And I'm going to soak these raisins in brandy for an extended period, and then rest the Belgian Doppel on it, and just kick it up a notch with some flavor there. So, and it turned out great. I even fed a homebrew jockey John here with a sample of it. He seems to
can't talk.
He's got his cup. He's got two hands around it, gulping it. I guess it turned out okay.
Yes, I'm getting some dark fruit notes from your dark fruit here, and
that's
then,
right.
And then some big raisins.
Exactly. Of course, one could say, "Hey, you put raisins in your Belgian Doppel, which has special B to give raisins in it, raisin flavor in it." That's almost like saying, "Hey, why don't I take my IPA and just put grapefruit in it?" Whatever. So here's the process. I take 1 quart of raisins, or basically a 20-ounce package. I soak them in brandy for 2 weeks. I'm sure if you only wanted to wait 1 week, that'd be fine too. So the raisins get soaked, and then when it's time to rack the Belgian Doppel onto it into a secondary carboy, first off, I take those raisins that have been soaked, and I put them in a blender because I want to beat them up so that the alcohol in the beer can extract, have an easier time extracting it. It doesn't take too long to kick it around in a blender. It purees very quickly. So put it through the blender, then rack that Belgian Doppel on it, and any extra brandy? Well, everyone goes in the pool. And I let it sit there. Oh.
So it's a fortified double.
It's a couple teaspoons, but yes.
Okay.
And nice. Nothing wrong with that.
No.
So I let it sit for about 4 to 6 weeks. In this case, it was 6 weeks. But I start tasting at 4 weeks, and I knew I was on the right track. I just, you know, I was in, I had patience. I had other beers on tap, which is a luxury, and I was able to wait.
So,
but if you're going to do something like this, you should be waiting anyways.
So,
don't be in a hurry.
Let me ask, so did you do this in a secondary fermenter, or this was all in the primary?
No, racked to the secondary. One of the rare times I racked to the secondary.
Okay.
Yeah, you heard it here.
Yeah, mark your calendars.
Yes. And came
Tom Crawford, Tom Crawford, no chill. Ron Minkoff, no racking.
I did do a chill on this one. I cannot overlap that on the one. But turned out tasty, and there you go, as John's cup gets empty.
Yes.
And now we're going to find out there's some extra things brewing in Gainesville. What would that be? Now, we don't like to do too many shameless plugs, and I don't think it's inappropriate to do a little bit of a shameless plug on this one, because this is some local news to Gainesville that the First Magnitude Brewing Company is about to open up this weekend. If you are listening to this podcast, it probably already opened up. But hey, they're going to they'll be open additional weekends, so not a problem. But we're opening. You're opening up for the first time this weekend after many months of preparation.
Oh man, years.
Yes, give a rundown on
what to expect.
What to expect?
Yes. So our tap room, the Source, known as the Source, is going to be open.
And explain why. I understand why, but explain why it's called the Source.
Okay. So First Magnitude refers to the First Magnitude Springs, which we have more First Magnitude Springs here in North Central Florida than anywhere else in the world. And these are springs that kick out millions of gallons of water a day. Manatee Springs, not too far from here, puts out 65 million gallons a day. It's just staggering. So we wanted something that would reflect the area, and First Magnitude seemed to be a good choice for that. And so the Source is kind of where all the beer flows from. And yeah, we're going to be open Saturday and Sunday. Saturday 2 to 9, Sunday 2 to 7. And it should be a good time. We're going to have seven of our beers, well, at least seven, hopefully nine of our beers on tap. And then we will have at least nine other taps featuring other Florida craft beers. So should be a good time.
All right. And when people go there,
right, sure.
Are they going to get beer nuts or can they eat something too?
What a great segue, because we are going to have several food trucks to choose from. We're going to have not beer nuts, but we're going to have soup to nuts food truck. We're also going to have the Fed food truck, which is a fantastic vegan food truck. Those are both going to be on Saturday, those food trucks. And then on Sunday, we're going to have Americana, which is a wood-fired pizza food truck, which is absolutely outstanding. So yes, we will have some very excellent food to go along with some excellent craft beer.
And that is going to be the pattern of each weekend that First Magnitude is open, I assume?
Oh yeah.
With food trucks, a lot of your beers on tap, and some other breweries.
Yes, beer on tap. Yes, we're going to have a good mix of our own brews, and then we're certainly going to be focusing on Florida craft beer, but that's not to say that there won't be a good regional or national brand sneaking in there every once in a while. But yeah, our focus is definitely going to be on Florida craft, and this weekend in particular, we want to highlight the many breweries that helped us along the way and gave us great advice and all kinds of different help. And we want to show our appreciation by having some of their beers on tap.
All right. Very nice. I wonder if I'll be there. For more information, you can go to fmbrewing.com or sure. Look for them on their Facebook page on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, what's your usual spiel at the end of these?
Oh, yes. My usual spiel is...
It's a little self-serving this time,
a little,
go ahead.
A little self-serving, but as we have been saying for the last 4 years on Homebrew Talk, support your local breweries and your local craft beer bars. And if you are so inclined, after you look up the First Magnitude Facebook page, look up the Homebrew Talk Facebook page and give us a like, for God's sakes.
Boy, I'm sure glad that's over with. Me too!
Yeah, but you know... I learned something today.
Oh, definitely. You know, if you're in a hurry, you want to use less equipment, hey, go no chill. It'll, you know, it'll let you brew in a clutch.
You know, and I learned if you want to take your knockout to the next level, step up to the plate, chiller.
Oh, God. All right, this show is too much. And we're done here at Homebrew Talk. We'll be back next month. But if you can't wait, you can always check out our past podcasts at homebrewjockey.com.
I'm too much. Too much.